Some of the problems Lehman Brothers executives were trying to shuffle off the book were those troubling things known as toxic assets. Toxic assets threatened to bring down the global economy. Hundreds of billions of dollars worth of home mortgages packaged into complicated bonds, and no one wanted to touch them. Well, now these things are starting to move, and our Planet Money team has been wondering what's become of them. They thought the best way to find out was to actually buy a toxic asset. David Kestenbaum and Hannah Jaffe Walt report.
There's no store you can go to buy toxic assets.
You have to know a guy, and we know a guy.
So, my name's Whit.
Whit Solberg. He used to work on Wall Street, and now he's set up his own shop, Mission Peak Capital, here in his hometown, Kansas City.
Whit and a dozen guys sit at desks with their tools. 2 to 4 computer monitors, 3 to 5 bags of potato chips, Snapple, chewing tobacco. And all Whit does all day is look at those monitors, spreadsheets, numbers, mortgage data, evaluating toxic assets, and sometimes buying one.
But the thing is, you don't always know what you're getting. Whit compares this to buying a cow at an auction.
The big black Angus cow that everybody wants, we're not buying that cow because it's too expensive. We want the cow that kind of got a wounded leg, but she might produce a few more calves for us. And is cheap. So why don't we run the 051 MV8?
Whit starts searching for a bond we might want to buy. And what searching looks like is checking your email. Brokers keep sending him announcements about which toxic assets are for sale today. One says, cheaper, super senior steel.
Bobby sends a lot of email. Cliff and Dwayne.
To figure out which bond might be a good buy for us, Whit has a computer model, basically a very fancy spreadsheet named Brandy, named after his wife, who built the thing. Brandy takes all the information on all the mortgages and tries to make sense of it.
If you bought a home in the last 10 years, it's possible your mortgage is in here.
And Brandy, the model, is asking these questions about you. Where is your house? Are you making your mortgage payments? Who made you the loan? She does this with thousands of mortgages. Meanwhile, Whit is scanning the screen, yelling, what's Brandy telling us here? Oh, Brandy likes it. Oh, wow, check out Brandy's loss severity there.
Around lunchtime, Whit finds a bond he likes for us.
It's a type of bond called an omelet bond. That's an acronym for Option 1 Mortgage Loan Trust. Whit thinks we should offer to buy the omelet for half a cent on the dollar.
In other words, less than 1% of its original value. Whit calls one of those brokers who sent him the emails, a guy named Cliff, tells him, half a cent on the omelet. And then we wait. Finally, Cliff calls back.
Hey, Cliff.
Hey.
What's happening?
So that omelet bond?
Yeah.
They're seeing high teens on that.
High teens, 17, 18 cents on the dollar. More than 30 times higher than what we bid.
That's bull. That's ridiculous.
Wait, so what happened with the omelet? Somebody bought it for high teens?
That's what they're telling the trader.
And you bid half a cent?
So there's real disagreement about what these things are worth.
There's huge disagreement. I mean, honestly, this is not uncommon.
After our omelet failure, we move on. Whit gets excited about another bond. He looks through his fancy spreadsheet. It has big loans, meaning big houses, McMansions in California.
But he only has minutes to make an offer on this one, and there isn't enough data to evaluate it. So Whit does something that makes me kind of nervous. He yells, print the book!
The book is the prospectus, a 604-page document no one ever expected anyone to read. It describes the bond in excruciating detail.
As the printer tray fills up, I realize I'm staring at an historical record of the entire financial crisis. It's all here on these pages. Vaporized companies, people struggling to pay their mortgages, and some horribly complicated logic describing which bondholders get paid in which order, how much, under which conditions.
Whit hunches over the pages with 3 highlighters and a pen, circling stuff, turning the pages quickly, time running out. And then he stops. There's a hidden time bomb on page 136.
You're laughing. That doesn't seem like a good sign.
In the event of insolvency of Lehman Brothers, payments due under the interest rate cap. Dude, this is a disaster.
The disaster is the deadly interest rate swap. You don't need to know what that is. It's bad. We're not buying it.
We go on like this for 2 days, and finally we find her, a beautiful, totally toxic asset at what Whit thinks is a good price, $36,000. The original sticker price was a lot more.
$2.7 million.
Meaning that's how much money, in theory, is supposed to be coming in from all the mortgages.
Wow,
so someone was holding it expecting it to be worth a lot more money.
Yeah, somebody, a human being or an institution paid $2.72 million for this
within very recent history.
And you bought it for $36,000.
That's right.
We buy a piece from Witt for $1,000. It's going to be our encyclopedia of the financial crisis.
So what the heck did we buy? Our toxic asset, she has 2,000 mortgages all over the place, a lot in the worst hit parts of the country, California, Arizona, Florida.
Here's a guy, pretty nice Sarasota place, right?
You can tell a zip code.
Yeah, there's a zip code, golf course community, maybe a cul-de-sac, something like that.
A lot of the people in our bond are really struggling. Almost half are behind on their mortgage payments. 15% of our homes are already in foreclosure.
And at some point, those homes will be taken over and sold for a loss. Every time that happens, the bond shrinks. At some point, our part of the bond disappears entirely.
But until then, we get a little money every month from people paying off their mortgages. We just got a check for $141. If we keep getting checks till Thanksgiving, we could double our money.
What's the worst thing that could happen?
Next month, they sell all the houses and you get stuck with nothing.
So now we're toxic asset investors. What does that mean? Are we helping unclog some big bank's balance sheet? Are we helping the homeowners?
No. You're not helping these people. If you have any reason to purchase this product, the reason is to make money.
But are we helping the people who owned this stuff that we bought
no.
it from?
No, because what would have happened was that they'd have to recognize that loss. 99. They would have bought it for 100, and now they've just recognized the fact that they've lost 99.
I see. So what we're actually doing is we're saying to whoever holds this, you think you don't know what it's worth, or maybe you think it's worth whatever, and we think it's worth two cents on the dollar.
Yeah, you've raised your hand, and you said it's worth a penny and a half. And by the way, that's better than nobody raising their hand at all.
Of course, there could be a reason no one was raising their hands. It could be worth less than a penny on the dollar.
However this investment turns out, we'd like to meet some of our partners in the pages of this gigantic financial transaction. If you bought a home in 2005 in Sarasota zip code 34232.
Or if you've owned our toxic asset, QSIP number 41161PUA9, let us know. I'm David Kestenbaum.
And I'm Chana Jaffe-Walt, NPR News.
In case you're wondering, our reporters spent their own money. Any proceeds will go to charity. If they lose money, well, they lose. You can follow their progress at npr.org/toxic.
Support for Planet Money comes from Ally Bank, committed to customer service. At allybank.com, visitors can chat online with a customer care advocate 24/7.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In New York, the state budget crisis is so severe that Governor David Paterson wants to close dozens of parks, campgrounds, and historic sites. The list includes the farm where abolitionist John Brown is buried. He led the raid on Harper's Ferry that helped spark the Civil War. As North Country Public Radio's Brian Mann reports, historians and activists are fighting to preserve what they consider a national landmark.
When Union soldiers went into battle in the 1860s, they often marched to a song performed here by Pete Seeger.
John Brown's body lies a-moldering in the grave, but his soul goes marching on.
Brown died before the war, executed in 1859 after he tried to spark a slave rebellion in the South. His body was brought home here to his farm near Lake Placid, New York. It's beautiful this time of year, snow-covered fields ringed by the Adirondack Mountains. Brown and his wife, who were white, worked the land with a colony of black farmers. Martha Swan is founder of a civil rights group called John Brown Lives.
He so loved it here, on this land, that in his last jailhouse letter to his wife Mary, he expressed his wish that she come gather up his and their beloved son's bones and bring them home for burial in the shadow of the big rock where he loved to sit and pray while looking out over the mountains.
A statue near that rock shows the abolitionist protecting and guiding a young black child. A black civil rights group from Philadelphia donated the memorial in 1935. Activists held a recent vigil protesting the state's plan to close the site this spring. Dan Keefe is spokesman for New York's Parks Department.
It's been very difficult. Each park is special. Each park is important. Patrons love all the parks in our system, and try and do this in an ideal way as impossible.
John Brown's farm had roughly 60,000 visitors last year, a fraction, Keefe says, of the 56 million visitors to the state's parks.
We looked at attendance, operating costs, what kind of revenue each facility generated.
Closing the burial site would save taxpayers about $40,000 a year. That's a tiny chunk of New York's $9 billion deficit. Historian James Stewart says that's not enough to warrant the loss of an important civil rights landmark.
There was a tremendous struggle trying to get sites designated that were associated with African-American history. And so to lose one that has such important value symbolizing a whole era of struggle is really problematic for me.
Unlike many historic sites in the U.S., John Brown's farm has been preserved almost intact, with the original farmhouse, the fields, and woods. New York's legislature still has to approve the plan to close the site. Last week, a state senator from Brooklyn introduced a resolution calling for the decision to be reversed. For NPR News, I'm Brian Mann in Saranac Lake, New York.
The Labor Department said yesterday that jobs are opening up at a faster rate than they have in a year. It's a sign, though a small one, that employers are starting to hire more. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports.
It might seem that there are no jobs available in this economy. In fact, there are millions of jobs created and destroyed every month. And at the end of January, the government said there were 2.7 million available positions.
It looks like we have now turned the corner in job openings.
Heidi Shierholz is an economist with the Economic Policy Institute think tank. She says if you divide that number by the number of people who are unemployed, that's 5.4 out-of-work people for every open job. That's not near the 1-to-1 ratio sought in a healthy economy, Shierholz says, but it's better than the recession's peak of 6.2 people for every open position. The Labor Department's report is consistent with the findings of Monster.com and Indeed.com. Both job sites said more employers posted jobs and showed interest in hiring in February.
We're nowhere near the kind of robust hiring we need to keep up with our labor market, but it's a very good sign that it's actually turned the corner now.
Whether people will get hired will depend on whether their skills match those being sought by employers, and yesterday's report reveals nothing about that. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
Some corporations report they do have work for people but can't find people with the right skills. At the same time, some laid-off workers are being trained for jobs that don't exist. Emily McCord of member station WYSO visited a community college in Dayton that's trying to address this mismatch.
Casey Wilson is standing in an expansive white room wearing a lab coat and safety goggles. She's holding a piece of woven fabric. It is glue on one side, and she's sticking it to a big metal bracket. She's learning how to make a composite. If this doesn't feel much like the typical classroom, well, that's because it isn't. It's a college course being held at Vector Composites, a startup research and manufacturing business that makes parts for aerospace and defense systems in Dayton.
All of a sudden, I got to go fill a parking lot full of cars. I don't have people to go hire because they don't exist in Dayton.
Tim Brocklehurst is the manager at Vector Composites. And while he wants to hire new workers, he's struggling to find people who can do the job.
You know, here we are with folks that have high school level educations. I've got a PhD in materials engineering that's teaching this class. We took us like 5 attempts to get this curriculum into something that someone without the exposure can understand. And that's difficult.
Casey Wilson used to work at a local tool and die company before she was laid off. She says this school experience is a completely new one for her.
They could have really taught this way above our heads, and they made a great effort to bring it down. I felt like we actually learned.
Wilson can expect to make about $14 an hour in this field once she completes her training. But let's back up a bit here. This class represents a shift in approach. In 2006, Sinclair Community College officials launched a study that changed the way they thought about job retraining. It found that there were both a lot of unemployed residents here and a lot of jobs going unfilled.
And people would say, well, just have those unemployed get those jobs. How simple, right? Just have them get those jobs. Well, part of the complexity was the skill set didn't match.
Deb Norris is with Workforce Development at Sinclair. The college used stimulus money to create programs for students who want jobs in manufacturing but needed a little help to get those jobs. So Tim Brocklehurst gets his employee trained in composites. Casey Wilson betters her odds of getting a job. Everybody wins, right? Well, Norris says, not everybody.
There is still very high potential earning power. You just have to have a different set of skills.
Not everyone is able to get hands-on training at places like Vector Composites. There are prerequisites, and many students need to take remedial classes before progressing. So getting a job in manufacturing can take almost as much schooling as, say, getting a job in information technology, or in Eddie Miller's case, as a social worker.
We've been so working on using our physical means to do a job, and now we're being thrown into doing a mental part of the job, and it becomes just an incredibly difficult thing to do.
Miller made trucks at General Motors before he was laid off just over a year ago. He has to take some entry-level classes, and he thinks it'll take some time to finish school. While he's fine with that, he worries about his former GM assembly line colleagues.
I don't know what's going to happen to the people. I don't know what's going to happen to me. It's going to take 3 years. Well, most of the people are going to be burnt out by then, or can't afford to go, or they have to worry about their mortgages.
Deb Norris at Sinclair College understands that frustration, but she says the job landscape is just dramatically different now.
The beauty of General Motors for a number of years was that they paid very, very well. And not only was the pay, but the benefits were just outstanding. And that was a beautiful, beautiful thing. But it's not here any longer.
For Eddie Miller and others like him, that's a tough reality. Miller says he has friends who've already given up on school, but he's not going to. Even though it may take a few years, he believes it's his best chance to find and keep a good job again. For NPR News, I'm Emily McCord.